Accession number 28759, reel number 1.
Right, we're rolling.
Graham Rowntree, reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Highbury, London N5, at 109 Highbury New Park. In London N5, I remember that was the address.
Which year, Graham?
25th of July, 1921.
What kind of family? What did your father do?
He was a general practitioner. And he practiced in that area. His family home was in Highbury, Richmond Road. And I always thought, I wondered how they all packed in there, because he had three sisters and four brothers who were all in the medical profession. And grandfather was also a general practitioner.
Did he have any experience of the Great War? Was there any service connection there?
Oh, yeah. Father was in a casualty clearing station in 1915, number 9 at Saint-Omer in the 1418 war, and he survived the war and then went back to general practice after the war. He had two partners, and they were Rowntree with Brown, the other partners. His private house, where he saw patients. In those days, general practitioners saw patients in private houses. And the doctor's wife was usually the one that greeted patients or people who had an accident on the doorsteps, and they were treated in the private house. We didn't have health centres. And then
What about your education then? If you were from a comfortably middle-class background, where were you educated? Did you go off to boarding school?
Well, in those days, when parents could afford it, they used to immediately send their children off to boarding school. Unlike nowadays, when they didn't. But I went to local schools. I went to firstly a private school where Miss Allen ran the school, where you learned to read and write and things like that. And then I went off to a preparatory school down at Seaford in Sussex.
As a boarder?
As a boarder. Tittenhanger Lodge, Seaford, Sussex, among about 60 other schools in similar Yorkshire. And I suppose you could call it a typical middle class education.
What about your secondary education? Where was that?
I left there and I went to St. Paul's in London as a day boy. My brother was older than me, 4 years. He was at Charterhouse. By that time, my father decided to go into semi-retirement, really. He'd been pretty busy most of his life. And I think the fees at these schools started to go up a bit. So, as my cousins were both at St. Paul's, and in those days, St. Paul's fees, because they were heavily endowed by the Mercer's Company, were £15 a term, which I think it's something like £15,000 a term.
Probably more. So, you were then in London in the mid-30s,
yeah,
moving towards the war. What memories do you have of, say, aircraft, say, the beginnings of the tension with Germany and the feel of impending threat? What were your memories of that?
I went to St. Paul's in And one of the things that rather appalled me was when I was in prep school, the entrance exam for St Paul's included Greek, and I wasn't doing Greek. So I had a sort of pressurised year's course in basic Greek. How I passed that, and I don't know, quite know, because I suddenly heard from various people that it was quite got to be quite bright to get to St Paul's. My cousin had been there, so we all enjoyed it. And it was a jolly good school, and didn't really, academically, appreciate how good it was. Because I rather liked the boxing and the swimming and the rowing, and I think I managed to pass, but I finished up. We had the senior schools were the eighth class, and I was in the modern eighth. And anyway, and this thing in 1938 was, and in 1937, I then decided I was worth. He said, what do you want to do now? And I said, well, I rather like, well, my uncle was an engineer. I like going to an engineering company. So they picked me up in the interviews, and I had an interview with the State of an Engineering Company. And there were air conditioning people. They made industrial vacuum cleaners, crushing machines, and installations and various things. And I got a job there as a trainee in the main office. And I worked for a dear lady who I thought was about 105 in the shade, but she was a brilliant one. She looked after all their naval work. And the Navy ships then, of course, any orders were given on Navy ships, it all had to be recorded. That's why they had a man called a writer, physically wrote, like whenever a ship was manoeuvring. And then they brought in, because Sturdivant's manufactured a thing called pneumatic dispatch. These things, because they were air conditioning, so they made fans and also vacuum pumps. So that was right in that business. And I spent my time with Miss Huckles, dear thing. And in 1938, my job with her was to make sure we sent invoices to the Navy of over £30,000 a month. Because she was on to me, you know, what business have we done with this month and get the invoices out, which in those days was a lot of money, actually. And well, while I was there, I was a day boy there. I used to go out by train, my mother and father. Originally in Esher, and then moved, when I joined there, and they moved to Bromley. He took over, because when the war, there was talk of war, and so on and so forth, and he had a great friend of his who was in the Indian Medical Service. My father's semi-retired, and he said, well, I've got to go off back to India. And the job here is vacant. He'd like to take it over. Well, my father thought he got a bit bored. I think we're doing nothing. And so we moved to Bromley, and he took over his practice. I used to go up from Bromley South and Bromley North Station up to Grapfrights and then walk to Victoria Street, where Sturdivant Engineering Company had a store in Upper Thames Street. We manufactured fans and all the other bits and bobs up in Lancashire, a place called Denton. And it was a lucrative company.
How were you made aware of the possible war looming in the horizon? What are your
memories of that? Well, mainly on the news. And while we were at Esher, my mother and father built a house. We had a neighbour who was an MP, Oliver Simmons. He'd been in partnership with a Belgian who designed a method of lock nuts. And they were, what it was a nut with a fibre insert, like a ring. And Oliver Simmons was a MP for one of the Birmingham constituencies, and was always standing up in Parliament saying, haven't got enough aircraft. You know, the Germans are building ships, and they're not supposed to build big ships, but they are building big ships, we know about them. That sort of thing, because we were friends with his children and so on. A sideline to that was quite interesting, because they were Christian Scientists, and they had a dog, which we being kids we knew very well, and the dog was rather ill one day. So instead of calling the vet in, they asked my father to go. I thought they could have had a Christian Scientist, but I don't know whether the dog comes in. So that's how we got to know him very well. And in Parliament, we read Oliver Simmons. He was very keen, and we should rearm. This was in 1938. When I was at school there, I was in the Scouts, and then I joined, when we moved to Bromley, I joined the Territorial Army. And I joined a regiment called the Kent Yeomanry, the 98th Field Regiment. And they had a battery and enough people in Bromley, and a battery at Tunbridge and Maidstone.
Why did you join the Territorial Army at that age?
I quite liked it, actually, because I was in the OCC.
At school?
Yes, at St Paul's, and I wasn't frightfully belligerent, but a lot of people do, though. It was sort of an extension, really. And I quite enjoyed going to the camps. Then I was interested in field gunnery, because we used to come down here to Oakhampton, 98th Field, and fire on the ranges there. And that's how it started, really. Well, then I developed a hernia. Well, there was some heaving guns about, I don't know. But anyway, when it came to the 39, September, we were mobilised, 98th Field. And all the territorial regiments were asked to produce a second regiment. And so there was the 98th Field, which is the main one, and then there was the 143 Field Regiment, which was formed. And my father said, you'll be going, I have a medical. He said, and you won't pass because you've got a hernia. You know, the cough please business. So I said, oh dear, like everything else in the army, people are mad keen to die the war. Because everybody, that's the really thing to do. It's either that or go into the RAF. And, I was in the, very convenient in the Territorial Army because we had a battery at Bromley. And so when I went for my medical, was going to come up. My father said, well, he said, I think I told you that, but you won't pass it. So I said, well, what are we going to do? He said, well, I'll get it fixed for you. So he rang up a friend of his, who was a surgeon, a fellow called Pierce Gould, because my father's at Middlesex, one of his brothers. And I had an uncle who was a surgeon. And it's not the sort of thing you can do now, but this was a Saturday, and I think, all right, I'll do it on Sunday. Where are we going to do it? So my father said, well, there's a nursing home here at Beckham. And it's mostly for ladies who are having babies. And so he said, right, and Pierce Gould said, oh, I'll come down on Sunday, we can fix it up. And the anaesthetist, my father's an anaesthetist, but I don't think he did the job. You don't usually do it for your families. But had it on Sunday morning, which was September the 3rd, 1939. And I remember hearing Chamberlain say, And if we don't hear anything by 11 o'clock, we are at war with the Nazis. We didn't say Nazis, it was Churchill. We were at war with Germany. And sure enough, just as he came through about 11 o'clock at Beckenham, the first siren went off since the war was declared. And there was the people there. They hadn't got a lift in this nursing home. And they were trying to carry the dear ladies down the stairs. I remember that part, and I was just coming around again.
You'd had the operation by then?
Yes. But, of course, I couldn't go. Sturdivant very kindly. They were ordered to be moved out of London. A lot of the firms were. And we moved to Sutton. Well, that suited me quite well, because it was quite near to Bromley. And so I stayed with them for 3 months, and then I was called up, passed my medical, and so then had to go down to Maidstone. But I was, instead of being in the 98th Field, because they had to join the 48th Division, I think, and they were out with the BEF, Expeditionary Force, for the first winter of the war. They had been digging slit trenches and things, and my old buddies were there. And nothing happened, virtually.
And so where were you in this time, then?
So I was at Maidstone. I was at Sturdivant for about 3 months, I think. 3 months.
So you joined...
I joined the 143rd Field Regiment at Maidstone, which was the second line of the territorial...
And when was that? That would be in October. No, in November?
Yes, November, yes.
November 39.
Exactly.
That's okay, but just to get an idea. So then you were down in Maidstone.
Maidstone. And they were starting training, and we didn't have much equipment. The 48th. We used to practice on 4-5 howitzers. But... when they went to France, the 98th, they had 18-pounder Mark IVs, which had a split trail. They hadn't got 25-pounders, came along afterwards. But we did training down there.
What kind of training? I mean, how did your life change? You'd been in the Territorial Army before the war. Now you were...
Well, I had an advantage because being in the OTC, I knew how to slope arms. I didn't stand to think like that and drill. And so I got a stripe, which was a great advantage because you didn't have to peel so many spuds and you had various duties, but life was easier than being in the ranks. And I knew what to do when we did drills, you see. Because a lot of the chaps coming in were basically didn't know how to march and all that sort of stuff, you see, but it took a bit of time. No, it was training, map reading, doing various things.
And this was the period of the phony war, so there weren't raids, there weren't...
No, they were shipped all over the place. And as soon as 143 was mobilised...
143?
Was the field regiment, the second line field regiment, to the 98th Kent Yeomanry. And it had a rather smart uniform. I remember I used to be able to take my... Well, we weren't married then, but I used to be... We used to go up to London, have a meal out at the Trocadero, I think, for a quid. And I used to have a rather smart blue uniform with ball buttons and chain mail. Haven't seen that again. Quite extraordinary. Anyway, 143 were then mobilised, and they disappeared over the horizon because they were sent to Iceland. And they spent the war in Iceland, Reykjavik. Because that was the staging post for aircraft from Newfoundland up to Reykjavik, and it was a big naval base, obviously. And so the I don't know whether, I think they, I don't know how many troops we had there, and he certainly had a field regiment in Iceland, and they spent quite a long time there, because I met up with them in 1944 in the UK, and they'd just returned that, then from there. Well, then, instead of me going to Iceland with them, I was, I don't know how it's appointed or called up to go to the 122 Octu at Lark Hill. This is the gunner training ground. So I spent 6 months there.
Training to be an officer, basically.
Yeah.
You were selected as obviously officer material and.
Yeah. Mainly because of the OTC training prior to that.
So
and I could do mathematics, which was, in the gunnery, that was rather important. Who knows that? Do this navigation from satellites that they do now. You had to work out often, you had to be able to read a map and do various other things, trigonometry and stuff like that, which was done at school. So
you were at the Octu then from January for the first half of 1940?
Yes, 19, because I was appointed to, after that, I was posted to Dunkirk at Hampt.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, that sort of period, that
yes.
first 6 months of 1940.
I've always missed that up, forgotten about that. When I was at the Octu, we had to, we were trained, of course, we had rifles and bears, things like that, and as cadets, we often used to have to, they got wind up about various landings and things like that. And so we often left Lark Hill and certain periods, I think they had periods by which it was, there were sort of alerts if they thought there was going to be an invasion. And if, and sometimes if there was an invasion, you were, set, you were stood down. But on Salisbury Plain, mostly we did that. We had defensive positions of places we got to go to and so on. And that went on until 1940 when the French had, the Germans had reached Paris and they'd taken over France. And
what about Dunkirk? What are your memories of Dunkirk?
I never went there.
No, no, but I mean.
Oh, at home. I mean.
Yes. How?
Well, it was when we were at the Octu and that was going on. We were in defensive positions inland. There were various stages. I remember on the coast, if they thought that there were going to be a breakthrough, and we'd return back to certain areas. We had defensive positions in Salisbury Plain, and. We weren't really involved in the field gunnery there. But, of course, we were being taught it all the time.
You were being?
Taught field gunnery, and because it was a school of gunnery anyway. And so we did a lot of firing on the ranges.
With what kind of weapons?
We fired, had 5.5s, which is a field gun of, what would that be, about a 6-inch. And we had, they had 25 pounders at Lark Hill, some of the first ones. We still had the old 18 pounder Mark IVs, which were similar. And then they brought the, with the 25 pounder, the innovation there was that it was on a circular base that dropped down, so it made it easier to manoeuvre when it was in position.
Which of the weapons did you prefer? Which were the easiest to use, and what was good or bad about them?
Well, it's a 25 pounder. Once you learned how to handle it, it was a jolly good gun, really. The Lark Hill ones were pretty good. They were easy to put in, get into action. And, I mean, I hadn't been in a war situation for firing, and I mean, I've not been fired at, but I was doing elsewhere. But later on, I'll be able to tell you, compare, because we had American 105mm, which I've got the gun books here, later on, and the difference between the two. But you must remember, when we're talking about American equipment later on, the Americans had the advantage of, before Pearl Harbor and they came into the war, of a lot of information from us about how various guns had operated, and bombs and things like that. And so they, when they obviously were able to prove their own equipment, I mean, the biggest advantage with the 105mm was it was flashless. And the 25-pounders, it was actually the opposite, it just lit the place up. So it was very easy to, for 25-pounder batteries to be spotted. That was the advantage. The flash at night was about somebody flicking a match. It was just as little as that. We very seldom got counter battery on our units. Of course, we had the advantage was that we actually didn't have a field gun in our regiment, 24th. We were converted to the, what they call the, I don't know why the British Army always calls their guns with names of clergy. Whether they think, I couldn't think beyond a cannon. And of the cathedral. I suppose that's the way they think. I never understood how the government thinks or how these people think of. But every gun we had had a biblical name or a clergy name. I mean, we had the thing, this thing was called the priest.
Which, the American 105mm one?
On a Grand Tank chassis. Which had limited amount of armour around it. And it had the snag, well, I'd better tell you about it later, but the snag with that is to move it. It had a 9-cylinder Wright Cyclone engine, which required high octane petrol. And in order to, when you were in the firing position, in order to manoeuvre it, you had to back up and go forward to the position again and pick up your points. And if you ran the engines, you had to have the doors open, which were quite thick armour. Had to have them open because they overheated and things like that. But otherwise, it was a damn good gun.
I just want to go back. Dunkirk happened. How were you conscious that Dunkirk happened? Did you meet any of your former comrades in arms who
joined the 24th Field Regiment, because they were there and they'd come out of it, but mainly from reports from people. But we got very little information, I thought, at the time. I mean, we were just known that, you know, we were in a ticky situation, and the Home Guard or the LDV were there, and we used to liaise with them. We had the Enfield rifles. We had some Bren guns. Issued, we were virtually infantry in that sort of situation. But it was, I don't think we were, we were kept in the dark, although we often wonder what the hell was happening, and I suppose, like everybody else, we got some news, but it wasn't, you know, right up to date and so on and so forth. There wasn't panic or anything like that, but it was there, and it was mainly the RAF, really, that sort of lifted the thing away from the land battles, you know, the Spitfires and the bombing that started.
Because that was during the Battle of Britain, wasn't
yeah.
it? Coming up to the when yeah. you were at the end of your Octave yeah. training. How we, where were you?
Well, we didn't do very much. Never knew very much about the anti-aircraft guns. And because some of our people, of course, when they were commissioned, that's the units they joined.
Sorry, Graham Rowntree, Reel 2.
Am I talking too much?
No, it's fine. No, absolutely not. You didn't know much about the anti-aircraft guns, you were saying.
Well, no, we weren't sent to that. Mainly, I think, because the Lark Hill, which was a school of artillery, was concerned very much more with the field guns. And that was a 5.5, and the 25-pounder were the main ones. And the 9.2s, the bigger ones, they didn't come really into the thing until a bit later on.
Was the quality of the instruction good?
Oh, yes, very good, yeah. Very good. I went back to Lark Hill, actually, because having come back, I came back while you were here. I came back from the Middle East and Italy and so on, and I had to go to the School of Artillery to learn about gunnery.
Again?
Well, they wanted to make sure that we were doing it according to the book, which, of course, you didn't necessarily do that in action.
Picked up some bad habits. Okay, if we then say we're now at the end of your officer training, which would be around June 1940, would that be correct?
Yes, I just checked the date that I joined the 24th. This is the 24th Field Regiment, which is the diary of the thing. They were quite lucky, really. They didn't have too many casualties in France. One or two. That's one of my guns there. That's the Colosseum in Rome. Jack Adams and I were the first British officers into Rome. Americans like to think they were first, but actually we were first. Because we joined an American group of tanks, Colonel Howes. Mainly... We joined that. We're not recording this, are we?
Well, we are. I mean, it's probably better if we don't jump
in. We can record it, but yeah. We were very popular with Americans because we had the booze. We used to have gin and whiskey come up with the rations, you see, but the Americans were supposed to be dry. Consequently, they used to drink too much when they got it. Here we are. They were great fellas. Just looking at the date here, so make sure we got the right date. Yeah, they came, the regiment got back from Dunkirk, and they were sent to Hereford in June 1940.
And that's when you joined them?
Well, I joined them just after that, because they'd moved to Cornwall. I'll tell you the date of that.
Well, it doesn't matter.